On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The public clamor over genocide in Darfur is almost off the hook now. Church groups and congressmen and college kids, and today, again, the UN all raising holy hell over the hell unfolding in western Sudan. Now, even the Holocaust Museum in Washington bathing its outside walls every night with giant projected images of Darfur slaughter and suffering. The heat is on in a huge way, but the Darfur rape and killing have not stopped. In fact, they're spreading, threatening to engulf more of Africa. Why? Some say because Washington is more interested in co-opting than confronting Sudan. Some say the Iraq intervention is enough already. Up next on Point, the Darfur crisis goes critical, and so does the uproar. We will hear in this hour from New York Times columnist Nick Kristof, who's been white-hot on Darfur for a long time, from John Prendergast at the International Crisis Group, who charges Washington is too close to Khartoum to push intervention, and from the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, where huge images of the genocide are now being projected every night on the outside walls. You can link to and see a sampling of those images at our website, onpointradio.org. But first, we go directly today to northern Africa and Chad, across the border from Darfur, where that crisis is now spreading. BBC reporter Stephanie Hancock is standing by. Stephanie, thank you for joining us there.
No problem. Hello.
Hi. Please describe for us the dynamic by which the Darfur killings and crisis are spreading into Chad. What's happening?
Well, it's a very complicated situation, but essentially, approximately 6 to 8 months ago, we began to see the early warning signs that the Darfur conflict could spread here into Chad. Now, there were a series of attacks, cross-border attacks, launched from Darfur into Chad back in about March and April. Now, fortunately, there's a very heavy rainy season here in Chad, which makes much of the terrain in this border area completely impassable. So we had about 4 to 5 months of relative peace in this region simply because Janjaweed attackers were not able to cross into Chad to launch their attacks because essentially the seasonal rivers had flooded and swollen and made the area impassable. However, what has happened since the end of the rainy season in the last few weeks is a dramatic upsurge in the violence here into Chad. Initially, the violence was close to the border, very close to Sudan. Now, however, it is coming deep and deeper into Chad, sometimes up to 100 or 150 kilometers inside Chadian territory. And I'm afraid the picture we're seeing here in Chad is very much, or aid workers have described to me, what we're seeing in Chad is becoming a mirror image of what we've seen in Darfur over the last 3 years. And that is Arab attackers, Chadian and Sudanese, but also Chadian as well, that's an important point to make, attackers on horseback, raiding villages, burning the villages down, killing indiscriminately, raping women, and forcing thousands and thousands of people, Chadians, in this border region to flee their homes. So there's really no doubt anymore that the Darfur conflict has well and truly spilled into Chad.
Stephanie, pull the lens back even further for us, if you would. We read reports of this conflict spilling all the way into the Central African Republic, far to the west of Darfur. What's the knock-on effect that's taking it there?
The knock-on effect in Central African Republic is slightly different. We're unlikely to see a sort of a Janjaweed-style attack that we've seen inside Chad. The situation in Central African Republic is that CAR, as it's known, shares a border where Chad and Sudan, where their two borders meet in the south. And essentially, there's a rebellion in the north of Central African Republic, and the government, President Bazize, the government of Central African Republic, has accused Sudan of backing these rebels and of letting them use Sudanese territory from which to launch attacks inside Central African Republic. Now, this, of course, is exactly the same dynamic that we've seen in Chad. Chad has repeatedly accused Sudan of backing rebels who are trying to bring down the Chadian president, President Deby. So essentially, we're seeing it's more of a military situation which could develop in Central African Republic, especially with new developments just this week, an announcement that Chad is sending troops into Central African Republic to help it fight off these rebels. And it's also gone into the fray and accused Sudan of launching a generalized war in the region. So what we could see is Chad and Central African Republic joining forces somehow to fight against or to fight back against Sudan. And that would be extremely worrying because it would mean that this conflict, it will just spread and spread.
So the Central African Republic and Chad now enmeshed in this. Meanwhile, back in Darfur, what's the situation? There's a tremendous outcry around the world. Is there any evidence that the Sudanese government in Khartoum is putting the brakes on the killing, the rape, all the destruction there?
Absolutely not. In fact, all the evidence suggests the opposite, I'm afraid, that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that Sudanese-backed militia are launching fresh attacks, certainly inside West Darfur. Just last week, in fact, I was actually at the border with Chad and Sudan and talked with refugees who fled recent attacks in Darfur just a couple of weeks ago. And the attacks are showing no sign of letting up at all. The refugees that I talked to who hit just inside the border, just inside Chadian territory, described a very, very frightening series of attacks where essentially eight villages and a camp for Darfurians who'd already fled their homes, they were already in a camp. This camp was attacked by Janjaweed, as well as about eight surrounding villages. It was a coordinated attack. The Janjaweed arrived at dawn at pretty much the same time in all these villages simultaneously, refugees say, and essentially it just was a mass slaughter. Lots and lots of people were killed, lots of people injured. Everybody fled their homes. I think thousands of people, up to 7,000 people, are believed to have fled their homes following just this specific conflict a couple of weeks ago. And lots of the refugees telling me very gruesome stories, for example, how young children were particularly targeted, young males, children as young as 3, 4, 5, young boys being killed by men armed with Kalashnikovs, with rocket-propelled grenades, all sorts of heavy artillery, going into civilian areas and just killing people. Mm. So there's no sign at all, I'm afraid, that the violence is diminishing.
Stephanie Hancock, right on what are now, sadly, the front lines there in Chad across the border from Darfur with the BBC. Stephanie, thank you very much for filling us in.
Thank you.
I want to go now directly into Darfur. We go to Janina. It's a town in West Darfur near a refugee camp named Ria. We're joined by Dr. Solomon Kabidi. He's Ethiopian there as country director for the International Medical Corps in Sudan. Dr. Kabidi, thank you very much for joining us. What are you seeing today in Darfur?
The Darfur, I think, towns where we are operating in two campuses in Darfur town, and the situation in Darfur town is quiet and calm, but there are actually outside Darfur access to other areas outside Darfur town is very much restricted because of security.
And what is the situation of the refugees that your medical staff are dealing with? Do they have adequate supplies? Is the situation in the camps themselves, is it healthy? Is it tolerable?
You see, we are now operating not in a refugee camp, but an IDP camp. In Janina town, there are two IDP camps. One is called Ar-Liad, and the other one is Abuzar, and both camps are inhabited by IDPs, and there are, including the IMC, there are other NGOs operating, and the situation in Janina town is quite safe.
Safe in the town, the camps as full as ever. Some groups have pulled out of Darfur, are no longer delivering services there. Are you worried that you may have to pull back yourself?
This, of course, is of the concern to all of us. But for now, where we are operating is relatively calm because we are now operating in town, within the town of Janina. But definitely the situation outside Janina is a bit difficult, especially the road to the different locations outside Janina is impossible, except with aircraft.
Dr. Kabidi, with a tough satellite phone there from Darfur, we wish your group luck in dealing with the circumstances there. Thank you for joining us today. I want to turn quickly to John Prendergast, who joins us in Washington, D.C., a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group. And John, there's a lot we want to talk about as to why there has not been intervention, but what are the latest reports first in the minute we've got before a break here that you're getting from Darfur and the surrounding area about the overall state right now?
There's no question it's on a rope downward. I think that all the indicators of mortality and illness as a result of constant displacement are spiking, that people are dying and being raped in higher and higher numbers again, just like they were in 2003 and 2004. So after all the sound and fury of the international community, all the wonderful speeches, I think we're seeing a degeneration of the situation on the ground despite all the activity.
Over the past year, more than 170 faith-based advocacy and humanitarian organizations came together to form Save the Darfur Coalition. You may have heard or seen one of their public service announcements running nationally on television, radio, on the web. Here's the most recent.
How will history judge us if they're killed? If he's starved, if she's raped again? Genocide is ravaging Darfur. 400,000 dead, 2.5 million displaced. Saving Darfur will take immediate action by a strong UN peacekeeping force, and that will take leadership from President Bush. President Bush, stop the genocide now.
Uproar all over on the walls of the Holocaust Museum in Washington every night now. Huge images of the suffering in Darfur projected there. But where's the action? John Prendergast, you've written recently about this. I mean, we've heard people ask for years now, what's going on? All the outcry, all the images, the gruesome descriptions of what's happened there, and yet not going in. You've looked very recently at the United States government and said, well, there may be an essential conflict of interest here. What do you see?
Well, I think that from the beginning, and it's one of these unspoken rationales that aren't raised at every meeting, that aren't constantly brought up publicly, but the United States has a fairly deep and significant relationship with the government of Sudan on counterterrorism intelligence sharing. And I think President Bush has been very clear publicly, globally, in the context of our global war on terror. He said very frequently, you're either with us or against us. And the Sudanese made a strategic calculation after 9/11 to be with us, and they had significant information because of Osama bin Laden's residence in Sudan during the 1990s and many of the terrorist groups that had offices in Sudan. So they got lots of information to trade, and they're basically trading it, in my view, for protection for their internal policies, which include genocide in Darfur.
So we know that years ago, Osama bin Laden was in Sudan, in Khartoum. But after all these years, there's still enough that Khartoum might have to trade with Washington, that it's enough to hold international intervention, or at least U.S.-led, at bay?
Well, I think it's worked for nearly 4 years now, since the conflict erupted in 2003 and the genocidal counterinsurgency of the government began. They've been able to hold off, particularly the U.S. I mean, you're not going to get leadership from the Europeans because of their commercial interest in Sudan, and you're certainly not going to get it from the Arab League because of their, it's a club of governments that are going to support each other. So it's up to the U.S. to lead on this thing. And I think it was compromised enough over the last few years because of the intelligence it was receiving from Khartoum for our larger war on terror. But I think that the patience, that the fuse is running out, the political imperative to respond because of the factors that you've cited in terms of the Save Darfur Coalition and all these other particularly faith-based groups and their demands that the Bush administration do something after all the rhetoric, I think that's turning the tide. And I think that at this point, we're going to see more action on the part of the U.S., but will it be too little, and is it too late? Certainly it's too late for 400,000 people who have died, but there are still 2.5 million, as you said, who are displaced, who are at risk. And I think that if the U.S., marshals a coalition and leads to try to get a solution, I think we will actually have a chance to end the suffering.
John Prendergast in Washington, please stand by. I want to turn to New York and New York Times columnist, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicholas Kristof. He's written a lot about Darfur, written very recently, and very
poignantly. Nick Kristof, thanks for joining us. You hear the huge public outcry out there. You're a part of it. Is it having an effect, or are we still spinning wheels on this?
You know, 3 years ago, if you'd told me that today Darfur would be a household word and, you know, that people would generally know what is going on, I would have been just amazed. But if you had told me that people would know the depths of the atrocities going on out there and that the U.S. government would acknowledge that and refer to it as genocide and still, you know, we would fundamentally tolerate it, I would be equally amazed. There's certainly been tremendous outcry, but it really hasn't translated into effective action to actually stop this.
John Prendergast, in his essay last week, reminds us of the moment early in his first term when President Bush got a memo from the National Security Council outlining the world's inaction on the genocide in Rwanda years ago. And in what John says may have been a burst of indignation or bravado, the president, President Bush, wrote in the margin of that memo, "Not on my watch." So what do you think is holding up stronger intervention, Nick Kristof? Do you see kind of trade-offs with Khartoum on intelligence, on the war on terror, as the break on this?
I think there are a few things going on. But first of all, I think we shouldn't exaggerate the outcry, you know, at a national level. I mean, on the eastern seaboard, there is a lot of it. But in general, my sense is that when your average member of Congress goes back to their district, you know, that they're asked an awful lot of questions, but that Darfur...
Not number one.
Background. Oh, it's certainly not number one, mm-hmm. And it's well down on the list. That there are a lot of people who are very upset by it, but I wouldn't quite describe it as a real national, a top national issue by any means. I think that there are a few reasons why Bush hasn't done more. I think that especially initially, he was very invested in the North-South peace agreement that he had really helped achieve for a separate war between North and South Sudan.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that was a real achievement for his administration. He was proud of it. He didn't want to upset it. And I think that meant he was reluctant to put pressure on Khartoum. And then secondly, as John says, we do have this intelligence cooperation and also cooperation on terror financing with Sudan. And I think that the administration was reluctant to put pressure on Sudan for fear that of interrupting that flow. And finally, I think there was a sense that, we really didn't know exactly what to do. We didn't have any great levers of power, and the administration was a little bit afraid that if it, raised the issue and didn't respond to it in some effective way, they would look ineffective, they would be hurt. And so on any given day, it's sort of easier just to slide along and not do anything.
And days turn into weeks and months and years, and here we are.
Yeah, and fundamentally, the public really hasn't held their feet to the fire. I mean, in the end, President Clinton didn't respond to Rwanda for fairly similar reasons and only responded, belatedly to Bosnia because the public and the press, held his feet to the fire. And I think the same has to be done with President Bush.
You say it's not necessarily a tidal wave of protests sweeping the country. All right. On the other hand, I can't recall this much uproar over an international situation like this, maybe since South Africa and apartheid. I mean, it's got some pretty substantial standing. John Prendergast, you're there in Washington. Does it feel that the protest is high? I mean, the calls from the pulpit are certainly not just from one point somewhere on the eastern seaboard. I've seen them nationally.
I think when you go around the country, you definitely have this sense that there are pockets, small and growing pockets of people who are willing to make this a political issue, an issue that they say, it matters to us how you respond, whether that's going to influence their vote or not is another question. But Nick's right, it isn't yet the tidal wave you need, the breaking point you need, but it is certainly, and you raised the South Africa precedent. I think since the anti-apartheid effort that American citizens and people all over the world, in fact, engaged in the 80s and early 90s, we haven't seen this kind of outcry, particularly on an African issue, since then. But I would also just caution and agree with Nick that that it isn't. The temperature has been raised a couple of degrees from, say, if it's a normal foreign policy issue, 98 degrees, it's been raised to 100 degrees. But to get the administration to actually act, because if the temperature's too hot, you got to get it up to 101. And that's the challenge. Will this coalition that's been put together, faith-based groups, secular groups, human rights organizations, be able to generate enough heat and noise to get the administration to move?
We're going to look at exactly what that action might be if the temperature hit 101, but I want to begin to bring our listeners in from Buffalo, New York. Ken is on the line. Hi, Ken, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hello?
Yes, Ken, you're on. What do you see?
Yeah. Well, how come none of these people in the Clinton administration worried about these sanctions that killed a million children in Iraq? You know, and what about these 500,000 people killed in Iraq in the latest war? You know, why do people think that they can trust Blair and Bush to show any leadership in Darfur?
Ken, let us pick it up. Let me put it, John and Nick Kristof, to each of you. Here's something that we hear on the sort of counter side. Killing and human rights abuses in Iraq were raised as a reason for American troops to go in there, and now we see what a quagmire that's become. Is that a legitimate cautionary tale about going into Sudan, Darfur? Are these apples and oranges? Nick Kristof, first to you.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, the Iraq war is not only killing American soldiers and killing Iraqis, but it's also killing Darfuris, because it's one reason for our inaction in Darfur. I mean, look, I was against the Iraq war because it just didn't make sense to me. However odious Saddam was, we had other tools like containment that we could apply. And I mean, I don't think that we should be sending American ground troops, you know, marching into Darfur. Frankly, for some of the same reasons, they've run into trouble in Iraq. But we have an awful lot of other tools that we can apply to Darfur. The solution isn't to invade Darfur, I don't believe, but there's, you know, so much more we can do that I think would end up saving hundreds and hundreds of thousands of lives.
We'll look at that, but John, first, the Iraq war, the fact of it, do you see it as a break on international intervention in Darfur? Is it sapping U.S. capacity to do that, U.S. willpower to do that? Is it a cautionary tale to other countries about intervention, period?
Sure. I mean, it's a shadow over every foreign policy decision that is made in Washington and in other capitals around the world. So the reach of Iraq is absolutely unparalleled. The other tools that Nick is talking about is absolutely correct. I mean, neither one of us are pressing for foreign military intervention in Darfur now. We need to put everything we've got into developing a real peace deal for Darfur, for negotiating such a thing, and then getting the right protective international force in to support the protection of the Darfur people. To do that, that's where Nick's other tools come in. You need leverage. You need economic tools and the legal tools and the diplomatic tools that we have at our disposal we haven't used yet. You don't go from doing nothing, which is the current approach to the Darfur situation, and sending a little humanitarian aid, to invading militarily. There are many steps in between, and we haven't used those steps for the reasons we talked about earlier.
We'll look at those tools. Let me take a call from Roslindale, Massachusetts. Charles is on the line. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I gotta, you know, whenever I hear these stories about genocide and, you know, villages being destroyed, and people talk about, the woman from the BBC talked about grenade launchers and these big weapons killing these little children.
Not so big, but big enough to do a lot of damage.
Well, exactly. And the question that always arises for me is, where do these weapons come from? Who's selling these weapons? And who's making money out of these conflicts?
Let us pick it up. John Prendergast, first, too. I mean, it's not as though they've got fighter jets here, the Janjaweed. A lot of it's pretty elementary. But what about the weapons flow? Is this just part of the African wash of weapons, or is somebody profiting from the fighting in Darfur?
You know, the Janjaweed aren't driving this war. It's the government of Sudan that's driving the war, and they do have fighter jets, and they deploy them in the context of their counterinsurgency, their genocidal counterinsurgency strategy. This is a government that over the last decade has successfully begun to exploit the extraordinary amount of previously untapped oil reserves in the south and central part of the country. They've become now a mid-level oil producer at a time when oil prices, as we all know, the time we stop at a gas station, are going up precipitously. They're awash in money in Khartoum, and they're using that money to buy weapons, and the Chinese and Russians particularly are all too happy to provide those weapons.
So, Nick Kristof, if you were to outline an action plan today, and if it's not just send in the troops, it's leverage and peace talks, what would that look like? Where would you push first? With what hoped for outcome?
Well, one thing is that we need to get a few other countries involved and put pressure on them. One of them is China, because, I mean, those RPGs and AK-47s that are being used to kill children in Darfur, those are coming directly or indirectly from China. China has three arms factories that it has set up in Sudan. China has played the role of protector of Sudan in the Security Council. We have to make this an important part of our bilateral agenda with China. And then there are some Arab countries that have to be brought into this to apply pressure to Sudan. The key ones are Egypt, Libya, and Saudi Arabia. If the U.S. makes Darfur a key part of our relations with those countries, then they in turn will apply much greater leverage to Sudan, and that'll have an important impact. Other parts of the package, you know, we've got to protect Chad and Central African Republic, because the cancer of Darfur is spreading westward and to the southwest, and it's not going to do any good to solve the problem in Darfur itself if Chad and Central African Republic completely collapse and remain in genocidal chaos for years or decades to come. We have to send troops there. There are no sovereignty issues there. We can send in gunships or fighters and frankly strafe the Janjaweed when they cross into Chad with the Chadian government's permission. We can apply a no-fly zone from Chad. There already is a ineffective UN no-fly zone that isn't enforced. We can enforce that from Chad, and partly as one more way of twisting Sudan's arms to apply political pressure.
John's calling from Cranston, Rhode Island. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. One of the things that I do not hear is China does have strong ties with African nations, and one of them being Sudan. And China does get oil from Sudan, and is putting great pressure in the United Nations for nothing to happen there. So it's somewhat protecting the government in Sudan. And I think that one of the problems that we have is that we never hear these side of the story. So it looks like it's somewhat naive to think that if the U.S. cares, then things will change anywhere in the world.
So there are breaks on this that aren't necessarily in Washington. Look to China. We hear that, John, and thank you for that. Let me go to Peter in Boston. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. You would understand that a section of Nigeria witnessed a military war in the 60s, a wholesale slaughter of the Igbos in the 60s.
Yes, so what's the lesson we should draw for Darfur right now?
Let me say this. The superpowers cannot be talking about genocide when they can't do anything about it. Now, the situation is this. The U.S. must tell Sudan that they are serious by, number one, declaring every Sudanese official in the U.S. persona non grata. They should close Sudanese embassy in Washington and in New York. They should sever relationship with Sudan. Now, I understand they're gathering some information regarding Osama bin Laden, which has helped in seizing this individual. Now, of what use is the Sudanese government to the U.S. or to the world when they are left alone to commit this evil crime that is going on now?
So shut down the embassy, shut down relations, declare them persona non grata. There's not enough in the intelligence relationship. Let me go to Columbia, South Carolina. And Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, maybe we're talking about this because we're all Americans here, but what is Europe doing? How come we have to do this again? We had to go bail them out in Bosnia. I was there. I mean, what are they doing to help the situation? And then when we go in, is everybody going to hate us like they hate us because we're in Iraq?
It's a reasonable question. Matt, let us pick it up. John Prendergast, Nick Kristof, there's a lot on the table right there. Why isn't Europe taking the lead on this? Why hasn't the U.S. just shut down relations with Sudan? Nick, how do you hear these comments?
Okay, first on the shutting down relations, I mean, I think that that would be a lousy idea, actually. I mean, we've tried the approach of not talking to bad guys in the case of North Korea and Iran,
yep.
And it just doesn't work. And in fact, you know, we do have three instances where we have gotten the Sudan to do things that it didn't want to do. One is to expel Saddam, expel Osama. Another was to reach the North-South peace agreement. Mm-hmm. And a third was to cooperate on terror financing. And in each case, we got it by twisting their arms and applying great pressure, but by talking to them. And that's what we need to do.
What about here. Twisting arms while keeping the talk going, the persona non grata classification?
I mean, I think we need to have, their envoys coming here and need to have our envoys going there. Now, we can apply, John in particular has really pushed for various sanctions against Sudanese officials, and I think mm-hmm. he's dead right on that in terms of, like, freezing assets of Sudanese leaders. But I do think it's important to, to meet them and, indeed, then to yell at them. In terms of Europe, the caller is, you know, is absolutely right. I mean, it's just ridiculous that France is, has stood up to the Armenian genocide lately mm-hmm. by making it a crime to deny that.
The genocide of a century ago.
Of 1915, while it refuses to stand up to genocide underway right now. Tony Blair talks a great game about helping Africa, and in some ways he has, but the most obvious thing he could do would be to help in a former British colony, and that is Sudan, where the slaughter is underway.
John Prendergast, what about it? Why not Europe? And you hear the caller's fear. The U.S. gets involved here again, and suddenly it's the hated interloper.
I think the European Union is so many countries in this multilateral body, many of which have fairly deep commercial ties with the Sudanese regime, and I think their general tendency, and I've toured around Europe and talk to senior officials in most of these governments mm-hmm. as part of my role with the International Crisis Group. And we, you know, their general proclivity is towards quiet diplomacy, is towards constructive engagement. They believe very sincerely, I think, in many cases, the diplomats throughout Europe and many diplomats in the American government, that we can get a lot more out of the Sudanese with incentives than we can with pressures. I mean, the Sudanese.
So where's the beef? The dying, we're told right now, is going on.
I think the beef needs to come from Washington. Andrew Natsios, the special envoy for President Bush, mm-hmm. has called. He said that the U.S. is considering a plan B, that if January 1st there is no solution in sight, that the U.S. will turn to stronger measures. I mean, of course, 4 years after the genocide began, this is frighteningly late. But as long as there are millions out there who still need protection, I think it's not too late. So the plan B, we don't know what the details are. I'm sure they are still negotiating those inside the government. But there needs to be a cost to the Sudanese government for perpetrating genocide. That's the bottom line. Mm. There has to be an economic cost, Nick hinted at a few minutes ago, and there needs to be a legal cost. The International Criminal Court has the case in front of them of Darfur. Some of these senior officials have to be indicted for war crimes and crimes against humanity in the near future.
John, let me ask you. Nick Kristof says maybe the main thing the U.S. could do, the top thing, would be to bring pressure to bear on Egypt, Libya, Saudi Arabia. Can the U.S. do that? The U.S. needs so many different things from so many of those countries right now. We've got Iraq and the Iran problem, now Lebanon kind of on fire. Does the U.S. have the chits to call with these countries? Is it willing to call them? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I think we do. I think we have the long-term commercial and political relationships that are necessary to bring that give us the leverage, despite the diminished view that the world has of America now with the backdrop of Iraq. I think we still have that leverage, and we need to use it. We need to just raise. You know, I used to work for a previous president, President Clinton, and when the Secretary of State or any of his top diplomats or he himself went out and talked to a world leader or a foreign minister, people count at what point you bring up an issue, and if Darfur is raised in our bilateral consultations with China as the 13th or the 26th mm-hmm. issue, or never raised at all, the Chinese know we're not really going to be serious about it. But as Nick says, if we get in there and start hammering away, okay, here's a trade issue we got with the Chinese, mm-hmm. here's North Korea, and Darfur is equally important to us as we say it is publicly, then the Chinese will get the message and they'll start to come around. You know, they're not going to veto something that we're pushing real hard in the Security Council. They have a history of backing down.
So where it lands on the list, where it lands on the list is important. We hear it. William's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It might be a good idea to go back and look at, see how we actually handle Rwanda in terms of trying to fix it. What do we actually do? I know we sent a Brigadier Dallaire down to Rwanda, and by that time, hundreds of thousands were already dead, I think. And he got there with no authority and really no forces to do anything worthwhile, and sat there and watched the genocide take place. This was a UN initiative. It was during the Clinton administration,
yep.
And maybe your Clinton staffer could talk a little bit about that and how that was so horribly ineffectual.
Let us look at the Rwanda example and the UN role. William, thanks for calling. John, what about it? Lessons from Rwanda here, and what about the UN role? Jan Egeland has been speaking out like crazy lately. I think he's today speaking with the Security Council. What do we learn from Rwanda? What can the UN really deliver here?
One side note, I didn't start working in the administration until 96, but certainly have had a lot of consultations or meetings with people who were there to talk about what happened. You know, let's first make the comparisons. 100 days, the genocide in Rwanda took 100 days, 3 months,
yep.
and it was over. This has gone on for 4 years in Sudan. I learned the U.S. government rarely reacts quickly to anything, as we saw in New Orleans and everywhere else.
But this isn't even a quick time frame anymore.
Yeah, but we have a long, slow fuse in Darfur. I think the lessons are, well, and your caller brought up General Dallaire, who is the force commander in Rwanda. General Dallaire was not wandering around scratching his head wondering what to do. He was calling for specific use of force and a specific use of diplomacy, with force backing that diplomacy to end the genocide. He had an idea, had a plan, and the people in Washington and New York and Paris and London and elsewhere who had control over what the UN Security Council would do chose to ignore that because there wasn't, as Nick talked about at the beginning, a political imperative to do so. That's the difference here. We're starting to build the political imperative because there are more and more people in the United States who are caring about this thing. Now that there's a choice, the UN is the appropriate vehicle. Kofi Annan has taken the lead in the last few couple of weeks, belatedly, on this question, and there is a growing international consensus around what to do. Fortunately, it's a very weak plan, but it's not completely ineffectual, and they've got to jam the Sudanese until they agree to allow for a peace agreement and allow for an effective protection force to be deployed to Darfur. And the UN has to be in the front and center of that. The U.S. doesn't have to do these things unilaterally. We have to work through the UN. And only when the UN completely and totally fails to bring about that kind of international leadership does the U.S. need to build a coalition outside of that. But I think that's always a last resort.
When, you say, but the time has clicked right along for a long time here. One more caller we can get from Washington. Ole's on the line. Ole, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
I would like to say that I believe that the government and the world community have failed, and not just this time, but again, and it's been consistent. I believe that when people speak calmly and coolly about how to move slowly and deliberately to intervene in genocide, they fail to do justice to the reality and scope of the horror and the terror and the mayhem. If this was happening in London or in New York, it would be considered essential to act immediately and forcefully. Government and the international community have never acted responsibly and expeditiously to end mass carnage and genocide. Just look at the examples of Sierra Leone, Liberia, Rwanda, not to mention Darfur.
Yep.
It's irresponsible for the people in this world that care to look to the leadership of governments and a global community that have never once acted appropriately and expeditiously. It's the responsibility of all the individuals that care to take off the rifles off their mantles and go together directly, just like the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Wow. Ole, we hear it straight up. Our time is so short. Nick Kristof, what do you say to that? For people who care, what's the best thing they can do today?
After the Rwandan genocide, Paul Simon, the senator from Illinois, said that if 100 people in each congressional district had called their member of Congress or written, that would have forced the political system to kind of lumber into action. And I think the threshold in an age of email is probably higher than 100 today, but there is some, you know, number of letters and phone calls that will get the White House to become much more active, to engage in the kinds of things we're talking about. And it's, you know, it's calibrated. It's not a, you know, an on versus off. There has been enough political pressure that President Bush has periodically talked about Darfur, has appointed Andrew Natsios, you know, has done some things. And those things he has done have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. But the many things that he hasn't done have cost hundreds of thousands of lives as well. So, I mean, I don't think it's particularly realistic to try to, you know, get people to pick up their guns and fly to Sudan. And I think there'd be problems with checking in a gun on a flight to Khartoum.
Just maybe.
But I do think there's an awful lot that we can do that is short of that. And those things people have done, those calls that they have made, maybe it seems incredibly ineffective, but there are an awful lot of people alive today in camps in Chad and in Darfur who are alive because of those calls.
We've got to step on, pick up the gun or pick up the phone, Nick Kristof says. Nicholas Kristof at the New York Times, thanks for all your work. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And John Prendergast at the International Crisis Group. John, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
I want to turn now for just a moment to Washington again and John Heffernan. He's director of the Genocide Prevention Initiative at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Mr. Heffernan, thanks for being with us. You are bathing the exterior walls of your building in Washington with images of the genocide in Darfur every night right now. What's the public response been?
Well, Tom, it's actually been great. We launched this project on Monday night, where Andrew Natsios came to an event here, as well as survivors from the Rwanda, Darfur, and Holocaust genocides, and spoke about their experiences. We had about 400 people, and then we all gathered outside to watch images of the Darfur genocide.
And what do we see in those images, John?
Well, we have three different projectors projecting slides onto three different sides of the museum, and what we're seeing is the destruction of Darfur, of the genocide, a way of life destroyed. What we're trying to project is both the horror and the humanity of Darfur.
What does it mean for the Holocaust Museum to make this very public exhibition?
Well, it means a lot, because what we try to do is honor the memory of the Holocaust, honor the memory of survivors and victims by responding to threats of contemporary genocide. 2 years ago, in the summer of 2004, we declared a genocide emergency, the first time in the history of the museum. What we're saying now is that the situation continues to escalate, spreading into Chad. Humanitarian operations are becoming more and more difficult to implement. And what we need to do is scream, in a sense. What we need to do is bring our exhibit outside and project onto the walls of the museum during this Thanksgiving, during this time of reflection and gratitude. And what we're saying is we're lending the museum's moral stature to alert the public to the urgency of what's happening right now.
The faces of this genocide screaming from the walls of the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. John Heffernan there, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We'll go out with music from the album We Are All Connected, produced by the Berklee College of Music to benefit the women and children of Darfur. You can hear the life in this music. Let's hope we can stop some of the death. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.